Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, I'll be chatting with author and teacher Katie Schultz about her new novel set in Afghanistan. The book is titled Still Come Home. Then Stephen Lewis will tell us about a collection of short stories, The Wolf Keeper. These stories were authored by his wife, Carolyn Lewis. At the end, Fleeta Brown will be talking with poet Jennifer Stein North about her new book, Awake with Nine Shades. I'd like to welcome Katie Schultz to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you.
Since 2011, Katie has directed the Adult Writers Retreat at the Interlochen College of Creative Arts. And Katie, kudos to you. Over the years, I've heard about your inspirational teaching and your wise counsel from so many of your students. When we last chatted in 2013, you had a new book called Flashes of War. Over the years, this book has gained a lot of traction as an important part of the literature of the Iraq War, and most of the pieces in Flashes of War were referred to as flash fiction. Would you remind our listeners what flash fiction is?
Sure. It's one of my favorite things to write and teach, so thank you for asking. It is a story of the moment, or you might say a work of art carved on a grain of sand. Typically, it can be flash fiction or nonfiction. Either genre is fine, and it's 1 to 3 pages long, so maybe 250 to 750 words. And typically, it just covers like a single moment in time, although, of course, there are always exceptions. We're dealing with really potent, often lyrical prose that just doesn't have to worry about backstory and primarily focuses on yearning, stakes, and precision.
And today we're talking about your novel, which is the opposite of flash fiction. Instead of talking about 2 or 3 pages, we're talking about 250 pages. How did this happen?
I'm still trying to figure it out. It was very dizzying, but I really did have to teach myself how to write long. And there's actually a connection to the impetus for the novel to this place here in Michigan. I could tell that story if you'd like.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure. So I was here directing the writer's retreat in 2012, and one of our faculty at the time for the week-long experience at the College of Creative Arts was Jamie Gordon, author of Lord of Misrule and other wonderful books.
National Book Award winner.
Right, that Jamie Gordon.
Yes.
And we were on a short break between sessions, and I just popped in to check my email really quick, and I had a message from an agent in New York who I greatly respected, and it said, oh, you know, dear Katie, I found one of your short stories in this small literary magazine published out of Idaho, and I really enjoyed it. Have you ever thought about writing a novel? And I started screaming when I read the email, kind of out of shock and uncertainty. And Jamie came running into the room. She said, who died? What happened? Are you okay? And I just like handed her my computer. And she said, well, why are you screaming? And I said, well, I mean, this is lovely, but I have to write him back and tell him, oh, thank you. But I know I'm not a novelist. I don't write novels. And she basically stood over my shoulder and helped dictate a message that I sent back to the agent that said, oh, yes, I'm so glad you asked. I am working on a novel. And are you interested? And I clicked send, and he wrote back several hours later and said, great, can you send me the first 50 pages? And I showed Jamie the message, and she coached me through the rest of it. But long story short, the agent said, okay, well, send me those first 50 pages in 5 weeks. And so there was my first assignment, and I had to learn to move from being a flash writer into the novel.
So getting into the novel, how did you learn novel form? How did you study this?
That's exactly the right word, studying. And the best writers that I know and respect are always studying. So I had many models to follow in that regard. What I knew I needed to learn about most was structure, the structural components of prose. So I had gotten really comfortable with scene, with metaphor, and with maybe single sentence long jabs of backstory. You can do all of that in flash and you should be able to do it well. But the novel is the long exhale. Charles Baxter says flash can win you by total knockout. But the novel wins you by points, if you will, go with the boxing metaphor. And so I had to figure out, how do you win the reader by points in the long exhale? I had happened to be reading a novel by Ursula Hedgey called Children in Fire. That novel takes place over the course of one day. And Ursula Hedgey is one of my favorite writers. I really admire her literary fiction. And I knew that the kernel of this novel that had been, you know, sitting in with me for all of 24 hours by that point was, I at least knew that it would probably take place over one day. So now I'm taking a novel length amount of time to answer your question. So I'll speed it up and I'll say that I basically locked myself in an office when I wasn't teaching. And on the left side of my desk, I had Ursula Hedgey's Children in Fire. And on the right side of my desk, I had a blank piece of paper and a pen. And I analyzed and copied and outlined her structure literally sentence by sentence. Here is one sentence of dialogue followed by two sentences of backstory and three sentences of description. Line break. Full flashback, including full scene and two paragraphs of backstory. Line break. New speaker. To that level, and then I modeled the structure but filled it in with my own content. It was terrifying. I thought I was breaking all these writing laws and the lawyers and prose police were going to come, you know, banging down the doors and put me in cuffs at any minute. But I, for the time being, I knew no one would ever have to know what I was doing or see what I was writing. Years later and many drafts later, the novel takes place over 3 days. It's told on the limited third point of view from three characters, and it resembles nothing of that original structure, but I never could have gotten there without the early imitation and education.
Imitation. It works, doesn't it?
It does.
So this book is set around, what, 2012?
2009, the summer of 2009, yep. And it's set in Afghanistan and Oruzgan province, and then also in parts of Western North Carolina, modeled after where I've lived for the last 15 years.
I was interested to see that come through. And most writing teachers, I think we're all guilty of saying this, write what you know, but it's also important to write what you don't know.
Yeah.
And these were worlds that you didn't know, life in an Afghan village, life in the U.S. military with a deployed unit, two very different cultures. How did you research this to get it right?
Thank you for seeing that. I really like to teach write what you don't know. I think in some ways it challenges you to cover your bases more precisely and thoroughly than you would when you start working with material based on experience. So in my case, I had done so much research for Flashes of War that it freed me up to focus on the structural components of prose when I was writing the novel. So that research was all already in me, and my learning could focus on the aspects of prose that were most challenging to me as a relatively new writer. However, when I was doing that research, it was everything from YouTube videos and satellite images from Google search engines or Google Maps to reading books like Doug Stanton's Horse Soldiers, for example, or watching documentaries to understand more about the burqa.
Which is the type of dress.
Yeah, whether it was on or off in certain provinces at certain times in history. a little bit about Pashtun culture, but there was so much complexity. When you get into Pashtun culture or tribal loyalties or even just the great spanning history of this beautiful country of Afghanistan, that I had to be careful to create a character that would feel authentic and whole, but that wouldn't bite off more than I could chew, so to speak. And so I found Asaya and her husband Rahim and made them work and double triple checked my facts, and I hope it's proving true.
And this was actually based on some historical information that you had gathered.
Yeah.
These events.
Yeah. So a story always starts for me with an unanswered question. And I had read this article years after the fact. It actually broke in 2009, but I don't think I read it until 4 or 5 years later. The first article was in The Nation, and then there many others followed. And it was about the host nation trucking practices. And in particular, this article revealed how American cash moved from hand to hand. So in order for the men and women living on forward operating bases in Afghanistan to get what they needed for their basic day-to-day operations of living and of conducting war, they have to have supplies. And those supplies have to be delivered. And they're not being delivered by, 18-wheelers rolling down I-81. They are being delivered by Afghan trucking companies. And the U.S. hired those companies to do the job. The only way that those trucking companies could guarantee safe passage of the trucks and the goods from point A to point B was to take that cash and to do what is legit and customary and common practice and part of a unique economy in Afghanistan, which was to bribe local warlords, hey, let these trucks pass through. And in turn, those warlords, in order to guarantee that passage, often would have to hand cash further down the line to Taliban that had various loyalties and holdings in parts of their provinces. And so you could see there's a whole other way of looking at trickle-down economics, how a dollar would pass from hand to hand to hand. The unanswered question I had was, what consequences, what singular moment could have happened because of the way these dollars moved? And I had the moment in my mind's eye. I knew the scene. I knew that it would be in the final 20% of the book, and I had to write my way toward it.
I'm talking with Katie Schultz, and we're talking about her new novel, Still Come Home. Katie, can I get you to read from the book for us?
Sure. I'll read an excerpt from a chapter focused on Second Lieutenant Nathan Miller. So this is limited third point of view. And you'll hear me mention Sissy, his daughter, and Tenley, his wife. So Nathan Miller has gone back home for a brief visit at Thanksgiving time, and they are at a local park in Western North Carolina. Sissy squealed with laughter and raised her pudgy arms as she whooshed down the slide. Miller marveled at the simplicity of it, how readily joy came bursting forth. He put his arms around Tenley and smelled her citrus shampoo and cinnamon bark perfume. Nothing about her seemed to give. He moved closer, but she felt iron-plated, as if any assurance this short time before redeployment might afford didn't matter anyway. There was so much he wanted to say, even more he'd promised he wouldn't hold back, but she would never understand what it was like to have someone die on your watch. "I love you," was all he could muster. For a moment, it almost seemed to be enough, but when Tenley pulled away, Miller forced himself to look her in the eyes. It was then he saw that her tightness stemmed from decisions she had come to in his absence. He recognized something fierce and bolstered there. She'd been fighting too, slow and steady, on the home front. He had waited to tell her about going back to FOB Copperhead in person because the bonus and promotion would set them ahead for the future, for their family, but he didn't tell her it was also a chance to prove himself capable again, the ghost of Mercer biting at his every thought. Studying her in the park, he knew waiting had been a mistake. "Baby, let's go sit down," he said. "We can watch Sissy from our spot." He tried to guide Tenley to the park bench, but she insisted on walking a half step ahead of him. He looked at her petite shape, the way the smooth curve below her ribs widened at her pelvis, the way her legs held her upright so infallibly. The war had done that to him, making him keenly aware of how entwined flesh and bone really are. Likewise, how readily they betray one another. But the war also gave the mundane back, offering the simplest pleasures in technicolor. Drip coffee on an automatic timer, the feel of bare feet across a carpeted living room. The park view expanded outward from where they sat, the horizon circling back as if it started and ended at Tenley. It may have been cliché, but Miller felt it. His world rose and set by that woman, her dimpled cheeks, her tiny earlobes, her southern drawl that came so softly and sweetly it made him woozy. She was the first woman he ever felt understood that his quiet way came carefully calculated. Others misjudged it for defiance or passivity, but she always held a vision of his highest potential at the forefront. He could feel it just as surely as he felt the mountains around them, holding everything together in this rural Appalachian bowl where Miller had moved his life to prove his love and come around to opportunities just like this.
Katie Schultz, reading from Still Come Home. Katie, the copy that I've been working from is called an advanced reader's copy, which means the book is not out yet. When will this book be on the market?
October 1st is the official release, although pre-orders will unlock sometime summer of 2019.
And where will the book be available from?
Anywhere books are sold, so you can buy it from Loyola University Maryland's Apprentice House Press website, from my website, katieschultz.com, from Amazon, from indie booksellers.
Okay, and I have to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Now we've gone from flash fiction to the novel. What's next?
Oh, thank you for asking that. I have been working on a collection of short stories set in Appalachia for the last few years. I am about 8 stories in, and that's where I'm headed. We'll see if I can round out the collection with maybe 4 more stories, and then I'll start thinking about how I want to have it meet the world.
Good. Thank you so much for being here. Katie Schultz, the novel is Still Come Home. Delighted to welcome Stephen Lewis to Michigan Writers on the Air. Stephen has been part of the Northwest Michigan writing community for 2 decades, both as a writer and a teacher of novel writing. Today we're going to be talking about a volume of short stories written by Carolyn Lewis, Stephen's wife, who died earlier this year. The book is titled The Wolf Keeper. Carolyn Lewis was a writer, a lawyer, and an editor of manuscripts and legal material. Let's begin with Carolyn's connection to this area. She grew up on a farm on Old Mission. Her ancestral roots go back to 1862 in this area. But after high school, she headed for the bright lights and big city. Do you want to add to that, Stephen?
Yeah. She felt constrained by the culture on Old Mission Peninsula. And so she did leave right after high school. went various places and wound up in the New York City area, where for a while she lived in my hometown of Brooklyn, which she adopted as her own, so to the point of writing a protesting letter to the New York Times in defense of her adoptive homeland of Brooklyn, feeling that the paper was being dismissive of the outer borough.
Ah. Stephen, there are 10 stories in The Wolf Keeper. Would you give the listeners a sense of these stories?
Yes, there are several consistent qualities running through the stories. One is her intense connection to the topography of Old Mission. She loved to walk off-road. The water of the bays drew her with great intensity. She had extensive knowledge of the flowers and fauna, which was significantly impressive to me, a boy having grown up in Brooklyn, where my flora knowledge was the generic hedges and trees, and my fauna knowledge extended to pigeons and an occasional robin, perhaps. Carol knew every flower and plant and animal and fish in this area. So there's that. She had an affinity for the Native American population who originally were on the peninsula. I think that arises from her consistent empathy and concern for the underprivileged members of society, including in a male-dominated culture, women, children, the poor, and the Native Americans.
Now, when you first met Carolyn, more than 40 years ago, she thought of herself as a poet. How did that early attention to language, the words and rhythm, influence her writing when she turned to fiction? And how did that all happen?
When I met her, indeed, she was considering herself a poet. She finished her undergraduate work at New York University in a program which I believe is still in existence called Gallatin, which enabled students to major in whatever creative performing art the student might be interested in. Carol majored in poetry. And in fact, I recently came across an anthology of college student poetry in which Carol was published back in those days. In terms of its influence on her fiction, her prose is poetic, particularly when she is describing some natural environment. The imagery and the metaphor are just bring the reader to that scene with a great deal of intensity. She also, and I don't know where this necessarily came from, had a good ear for dialogue, which is a skill that many beginning writers have difficulty with, but she handled marvelously well, particularly in the voice of a child.
Now, one of the things you told me in an earlier conversation was that even when she was living in New York, most of her stories were about this place, Northern Michigan.
Absolutely. She had left, as we said, for various reasons, but she never wrote about anything but this area. She was drawn to it as much as she might have adopted Brooklyn. She never wrote a word about Brooklyn or environs. She just had an affinity for this place and where she had grown up, and it clearly became the target for us when I retired from teaching. She wanted to go home, having lived in New York, experienced it, and she said, I'm going to go home now. And I said, okay, your turn.
Carolyn once told me she often spent a year working on a short story. You were familiar with how she worked. Why did the process take so long?
I think the short answer is Carolyn was a perfectionist in all that she did. Very thorough. She was an excellent researcher. If that trait is inheritable, as it might be, she got it from her father, who was equally thorough. One might almost say tiresomely so. He would not like to nail down every detail in whatever he was talking about. So when Carol wrote, she was as thorough in trying to get it and as perfectionist as she could. And the proof of this is on her computer, where she wrote continuing drafts, rewrites of whatever she was working on. And the interesting, quirky thing that she did, which I tried to talk her out of unsuccessfully, was that each time she saved whatever she was working on, she saved it with a new date so that she kept the previous files, not created a new one that absorbed the changes. I think because she thought, maybe I took something out that I shouldn't have taken out. I'll go back and take a look and make sure it's, you know, I have what I want.
So when we talk about craft, how is Carolyn's attention to craft reflected in the work, in these short stories?
Okay, the best example of her craft, and I would say a developing craft, because it was evident in the last story that she was able to write before she lost her ability to compose, was the one which we made, the title story, The Wolf Keeper. And she did something in that story which was remarkable and something I had not seen in her previous work. And that was the shifting points of view. Well, she'd done that in other stories. But in this case, one of the points of view was that of a wolf, as well as a dying priest and a young Indian girl. And she switched seamlessly one to the other, all presented with great authenticity.
We're really fortunate that we have a recording of Carolyn reading part of the short story, The Religion of Loss. This was recorded in 2004. Would you give our listeners a sense of what they will be hearing?
Well, that story has several of the attributes that are consistent in Carol's work. One, of course, is her empathy for the Native Americans. So the protagonist is a young Native American girl. Consistently in her fiction, she dealt with young girls as protagonists, which I suppose is not at all unusual for a writer to do. I think what is also most interesting in that story is the clash of the Native American spirituality being subsumed by Christianity, as the young girl is in a church trying to figure out what this figure on a cross really represents and how she's supposed to respond to it.
And now Carolyn Lewis in her own words.
Well, this is a story that was, and I think this might have been, I think this was my second story, it's hard to remember now, which was published in the Sycamore Review, Summer Fall 1999, Volume 11. And this story, I was still working with the Ottawa Ojibwa Indians. And so part of this is that a child who's 6 years old has been left in a church by her mother. And the mother is Ottawa Indian, and the father is white. Mm-hmm. So this is what happens, well, a little bit of what happens to her at the end. Her father has come to get her out of the church. My father, leaning forward, one finger lifted dank black bangs from my face. I scuttled away from him on the organ bench. Peace and Dolwichin, listen to me, he coughed, black spittle onto the floor. His voice crackled hoarse and his face reddened as if with fever. He lifted his head. I'm sorry I scared you, little one. Papa, where'd you come from? Fishing for salmon. Fishing? They're running up the Kanigan River to lay eggs. Oh, did you get any? Three big ones. How'd you know I was here? I heard your flute. All the way over by the river? All the way over by the river. You mean you could hear it that far? I could hear you if I were on the other side of the world. Really? Really. It's a very good flute. Mummy gave it to me. I know. I think she made it for me. I think she did. Why are you here? Mummy said she'd be back in just a minute. How long have you been here? Oh, since it was light, I think. Since it was all night? Oh, no, Daddy, just a few minutes, I'm sure. I fell asleep because I was scared, but it wasn't long, was it? She said she'd be right back. Do you want to come home with me? Oh, is it okay if I go? It's okay. He sighed then, a deep, long, rasping sigh that ended in a cough. He lowered his head onto his hands, and I saw his hands shake, but I didn't know why. I thought to pat his shoulder and almost did, but then didn't. I was trembling like a little bird ruffling its wings in the cold. "I'll wait for you by the door," he said. He walked to the window behind the pulpit where the fire did not burn, turned on his heel, and strode out. I crept out of the organ pit and stood at the front of the church looking down the carpet. I watched my father's silhouette push the big door wide. The rain had begun through the open door, and its spears flashed in the dark like crystal breaking, while wind blew leaves in along the carpet and beneath the pews. I smelled his river odor lingering and trailing to the door. Turning to the man on the cross, I thought to say something, but I couldn't think what. And then I remembered and put my hands together and, kneeling below him on the carpet, said, "If she comes, tell her I've gone with my dad so she won't worry." Hmm. And I clambered down the one step to the rug and turned and knelt again. Amen. Charging down the aisle and outside, I moved the big door heavily to close it and was startled by the blackness of night. He pointed, "I will wait for you right there next to that tree. Please go tell her I'm sorry." He dropped one large salmon at my feet, and hefting the two others over his shoulder, he disappeared up the embankment to stand under the limbs of a large maple, melding into the trunk, darker than shadows. The rain jabbed me like ice picks, but I had been asked to do this, and I was still a good kid then. Wrapping the gill rope around both fists, I dragged the heavy fish by lunging and yanking and heaving it along the gravel road. It was as long as I was tall and kept slapping the ground with its tail because it was not dead. Smack, smack, smack. Iridescent scales scraped off on the small stones, and when I turned to look behind, the path gleamed luminescent in the rain. In the silver drizzle, in the dark night, on the graveled road, the salmon finally was too much for me to pull. I dropped it before I reached the minister's porch in the parsonage and let it lay. I knocked twice. The reverend answered, dressed in pants and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up, tucking his shirt into his pants. I said, as any six-year-old would, "I want my mother." But he did not reply, and she did not come. Instead, looking out at the road, he stepped out onto the porch, down the stone step, and strode to the gravel road with the rain beating on him. Reaching down, he picked up the gill rope, and he picked up the salmon whose tail slapped the ground a weak slap. He walked back with it in his arms, and stepping up onto the step, turned into the parsonage door, and closed the door with the great fish in his arms, until only a thin light shone from the window, and even that seemed scant enough to see by. Like rain sprung loose and falling, I shook until remembering. I turned and made my way to the tree. My father picked me up and hugged me close, carried me all the way through the dark woods, over the moonlit meadow, along the slender path through the trees, and back into my mother's house where she no longer stepped. And I lived with him there until the music my mother had taught me ceased to play in my head, and I learned that life with my father began with the sound of one fish slapping the dark, wet, fertile ground.
That was Carolyn Lewis reading part of the short story, The Religion of Loss. Stephen, what motivated you to do this collection of short stories?
Two persuasive motives. The first was I knew how intensely Carol wanted to get this collection out. She actually had been working and putting it together for 6 or 7 years before it took shape to the point where it could be sent out. And secondarily, and more selfishly, both for me and for the rest of the reading population, I wanted these stories preserved between the covers of one book so that people could access them. Stories such as these, published in periodicals, journals, become ephemeral, gone as soon as the next issue of that periodical comes out, and very difficult for anybody to access them.
Stephen, what is the best way for listeners to get a copy of The Wolf Keeper?
Well, they can go downtown Traverse City to Horizon, which is stocking the book. Other booksellers can get the book for any reader who is interested. And, of course, one can go to Amazon, where it's available both as a paperback and a Kindle edition.
Stephen Lewis, thank you for being here. What a wonderful piece of work. You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. I'm here today with Jennifer Sperry Steinorth, and we'll be talking about her new book of poems, Awake with Nine Shades. Jen has previously won the 2010 Michigan Writers Cooperative Press Contest with her chapbook, Forking the Swift, and she's had many poems since published in major journals. She has a Master of Fine Arts in Poetry from Warren Wilson College, and she's received grants from and been a participant at the Community of Writers at Squaw Valley, the Suwannee Writers Conference, the Vermont Studio Center, and the Bear River Writers Conference. Awake with Nine Shades is Jen's first full-length collection from Texas Review Press. So here we are, and this is Michigan Writers on the Air, and we are in Michigan. And I'm wondering, Jen, what do you think of when you think of your work in connection with being a Michigan writer?
I've given some thought to that, and I think that my poems may not always be readily recognizable as Michigan poems in that I don't necessarily talk about specific places, but water is a big feature and comes up quite a bit in my work. And I think the landscape itself, we live in this place that is for so many months blanketed in white. The water is big and flat and spacious. So there is a sense of spaciousness and emptiness that formally I think is represented in my work. And I think the community here is very much an influence on my work, the voices that I hear traveling and the way that we often are enveloped in the snowy landscape and, you know, pulled into interior spaces for long periods of the year as well. I think those are ways that
which brings me to a poem that that I'm fond of, and it's called Blizzard. I wonder if you'd read that one.
Absolutely. Blizzard. Even as it's happening, us in the squad car, watching the wrecker reel our broken wagon onto the trailer, squinting through wet gusts that make the whole of it disappear. I can't believe it. What? The fact of our accident's certain occurrence, certain fatality briefly averted? No, these I believe. But the opaque mass of gray-celled drifts, the storm's full stop and existential rift, snuffing eyes hold on matters appearing fixed, then proffering the handle of vision back again. The squad car lights, pulsing hazards, our car, their car, wrecker, blink. Blindness, a gulf, we cannot leap.
So this poem is rich with trouble and the threat of trouble. It isn't related directly to the title of your book, but your book seems to pick up a lot of the tension of that particular poem. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the title of the book and how you developed the how you arranged the book around that title.
Absolutely. I think weather is something that figures into the book in various ways: socio-political weather, natural weather, and the title "Awake" is two words: a wake with nine shades. The word "wake" appears in multiple titles of poems throughout the book, and by wake, I mean wakes on the water. I mean the wake that occurs after the death of a dear one, and also waking up. So there's an insomnia sequence that occurs in fragments throughout the book. Little fragments appear and then dissolve, and then another poem will come onto the page, and then there'll be some more fragments of this sort of insomnia sequence. So the long insomnia poem is based on a poem by Carolyn Bergvall via 48 translations of Dante. And in her poem, she is reading 48 different English translations of the first three lines of Dante's Inferno, which is various versions, but one version is midway through the journey of my life, I found myself in a dark wood, the right road lost. And in my collection, the speaker keeps waking up in the middle of the night. So one of these versions is midway through our night's sleep, I woke to find the dream lost, my body shaken from its salt. Next comes, at the midpoint of the night we were allotted, I found myself in dark apartment. So these fragments become a sort of lyric that weave throughout the poem, a sort of waking up that keeps happening through various sorts of accidents or turmoil or storms. And so that's one of the ways that the title is figuring in with wake. And then the shades also references Dante. In Dante's Inferno, the poet goes down into the underworld and is engaging with the ghosts that he refers to in most English versions as shades. And so there are multiple ghosts that appear in this book as well.
Besides the wake used in multiple ways, it feels that there is a particular instance that keeps recurring. And I'm finding that in a poem, Wake and an Island. Would that be a good one for you to give us?
Absolutely. Wake and Island. Pressed between blue pages, a few hours on our old boat, which is not ours, my leg over the bow, you in the stern with the kids in the stern. I'm reading poems. You're not the sky, a depression of noon wilting on our way back from the island we did not reach. The boys drag bits of pita through some dip, argue the last cola. We are not arguing now. I said what I thought, you said what you thought, and I won. It's not nice. What do you want? I said, and you don't know. It's been so long since I even wondered, you said. Pinned here in this book, almost no wind, none, the water glass, like old glass, that much ripple, that much distortion. Two small sailboats go by port side, one red hulled, the other white. It's not our boat. Your father's gone. Days don't get more beautiful than this. The white hazed blue, a few big clouds. We could not stand it any bluer. And the land rolls up away. The glass reflects the sky. Thank God we cannot see ourselves, for home we're headed. Nothing violent, nothing shattered. Glass, the surface just before us, always smooth, always untouched. And when we mar it, it repairs itself with no help from us.
That poem seems to return to the smooth surface, but open up just a chasm right in the middle of the poem, or not a little bit farther from the middle. It's not our boat, your father's gone. And I noticed that this happens, as you said before, a lot of times in the book. There are places that just kind of open up little windows to a narrative that never quite breaks the surface. It's almost like it's partial sleep and waking. Oh, waking like that. Mm-hmm. How did you plan the arrangement of the poems in this book?
It saw a lot of different arrangements. One of the things that I came to feel was that there were many threads and I needed to weave it together a little bit tighter. And it came to feel like the various pieces were not as distinct from one another as they might seem to be. By that I mean the poems, there are many distinct poems. They each have their own title, they have their own pages, but there are a way in which they all feel like they're part of a singular whole in my mind, and trying to balance the various different sensibilities and losses. There's the loss of my father-in-law that figures in. There's some financial insecurity. There are political, socio-political climate that we're in that feels tumultuous for us, but then even more tumultuous for others in the world. All these things felt like they were part of one tapestry. And so I took the fragmentary piece that was the insomnia poem and broke it up and used it to sort of weave together the other pieces. So these little fragments become sort of stitches that hold together the other poems and some of the other disparate sensibilities, I hope.
Speaking of stitching together, some of the marks that you use in the book, in the poems, sometimes within the poems, slash marks backward, slash marks forward, and large spaces and suddenly small spaces, and it might leave a reader who's unaccustomed to that feeling a little lost. I'm wondering what advice you would give a reader about how to enter your book and how to travel through your book.
The marks and the various distances, the use of white space, is not meant in any way to push the reader aside, rather to help the reader. So I would say if seeing such a thing feels uncomfortable, if they can be okay with that level of a little bit of discomfort, that some of the material is uncomfortable and the space is meant to allow the reader to have space to move from one idea to another and give them space. Sometimes the white space on the page for me is evoking time. Sometimes it's a shift from one voice to another. Sometimes the slash marks are meant to evoke a sort of abruptness between taking one thing and shoving it against something else. And however the reader is experiencing this, there isn't a right way. It's whatever their experience is their experience. And I hope that it's able to give them space to enter difficult ideas for themselves in ways that feel like they have a friend, like they are not alone.
I found an interesting clue in the book. and that is that your father-in-law was a great fan of Robert Frost, and at some place in the poems, you mention that one of the problems you had with Robert Frost is the fact that the poem is so finished, so completely, in a sense, kind of sealed off by being finished. And so when I read your poems, I'm reading with that information in mind, that the poem is always in the act of creating itself. And so if I'm uncomfortable, it might be my discomfort with having to be within something that's not completely formed. Is that am I reading the way you would like me to read?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely, it's a beautiful reading of it. I also think sometimes it's that the poem may not be trying to create closure where there isn't closure, or where there may not, where closure may not, at least for this poet at this moment, be possible. And, but yet I don't feel that just because we haven't found closure that we must turn away from things, that sometimes we have to remain present in uncomfortable spaces in order for knots to begin to unravel, even if they don't get all the way there. So that's my hope.
I see a lot of concern with the private, the very private grief and the private world and the public. And I'm wondering how you negotiated that territory. I mean, it's something that almost all of us who write about things that are very close to us have to struggle with. How do you negotiate that territory?
Carefully. you know, I try to pull in larger things that are recognizable to others. Try to see where my life is a small version of a larger story, and where I can draw on those larger stories to illuminate something personal, and maybe in so doing, maybe surprise myself. That's always the hope, is, and I found most of the poems that have remained in the book through the various drafts are poems where I was truly surprised in what was revealed in the writing of them. So one of the ways, I think, Ordinary Shears maybe would be a good...
It would be.
...poem to illuminate that. In this poem, well, there's a big iconic figure. I'll read the poem and then I'll share a little bit about that. Ordinary Shears. Scarlett O'Hara refashioned herself, a gown of emerald velvet curtains flanking book-length drawing room windows, the twisted tassels looped in loose embrace round her corseted waist, dark locks festooned with smart pleated hat and verdant plumes. Her tragedy, now iconography. In our rooms, love, there are only shears, gauzy raiment of dingy lace that whimpers in faintest breeze, obscuring nothing but the hard edges of trees in winter. Anyone outside in the dark could see us wielding small cruelties together and apart. It doesn't make us stars.
Jennifer Sperry Steinor, thank you so much. And I want to mention that if our listeners would be interested in finding out more about Jen Steinor, where she's reading, what she's doing, you can check out her wonderful website at
jennifersperrysteinorth.com.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fleeta. Thank you, Erin.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Katie Schultz, Stephen Lewis, Jennifer Stein-North, and Fleeta Brown. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanshura for his skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, this is Aaron Stander wishing you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.